I have many things, but now I have even less. My mop is gone, and a few days ago I went to get myself a drink of milk from the fridge, and the fridge was completely empty. Again, they only left an apple and an onion. What am I supposed to make myself for supper that involves only an apple and an onion? This is preposterous. I have been locking both the door handle and the deadbolt, and you and I both saw that there is nothing in the attic, but I know for a fact that the girls downstairs can get in here with their keys. I think it's Suna, actually, who's doing all this. I don't know what she's up to, but you can't let her get away with this crap just because you're all goo-goo-eyed over her. I can tell. I'm perceptive about these things. I'm not saying you need to evict her. In fact, I don't think you should. I don't know where she'd go. She doesn't seem bright enough to fend for herself, so maybe it's best she's here with me. But at least change the locks on my door and call me back. This is... A beep, and Maud's voice was snuffed out. There was no more room in Larry's message inbox. Thank goodness, he mumbled to the ceiling. Maybe now she'd take a break for a few minutes so he could use his own phone for an outbound call. He typed in the number on his rental paperwork, and it rang a few times before Mackenzie picked up. Hello? He could tell she didn't have his number programmed into her phone. That or she was very perplexed about receiving an out-of-the-blue phone call from her landlord. Hi, Mackenzie, it's Larry. Your landlord? He probably didn't need to specify. How many Larrys could a teenager possibly know? Oh, hi, Larry. Hi. He was talking in an extra businessy voice, like he was about to ask her if she had enough life insurance. I was wondering if you would, go for coffee with me. He had planned, when he made this phone call, to launch straight into an explanation from the invitation so that she wouldn't think he was asking her out. But then he got a tickle in his throat and had to clear it, and that gave her enough time to say, Oh, Larry, I'm actually seeing someone. No. He didn't want to be the creepy landlord. Business. Oh, he said, trying to sound even more professional. No. That didn't sound as professional as he'd hoped. Ha ha. Maybe it would be best to lighten the mood. Ha ha, no. This was a disaster. No, let me start over. But first, let me just say that I don't want to go on a date with you. Ha, 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 no. He needed to stop saying ha and no. Not in a rude way, right? Just in a, well, I'm pretty old kind of way, compared to you. I was actually calling because I saw your article in Razor Cake, or at least I think it's you, assuming Kate Weiss is... pen name, Mackenzie said. Still sounding very confused and a little defensive. Yeah, and I would like to, also write for Razor Cake, or actually any magazine or newspaper or website or, yeah, anything music-related. I would like to write about music, like you do, and so... Larry lurched through his prepared speech like a 15-year-old trying to learn how to drive stick. Was he making sense? Was he freaking her out? Oh... Mackenzie got it now, he could tell. I'm so sorry, Larry. Of course. You want some pointers? About submitting your work to publications?
Yes.
The relief flooding through him was palpable. Yes, I would. And I'd pay you for your time. And I'd buy your coffee, but not in a creepy way. Mackenzie laughed. Larry, I think that would be really fun. Honestly, I like talking about that stuff. You wouldn't have to pay me. But I'll let you buy the coffee.
Well, good. Great. Okay, then.
This was something that he'd always noticed old people said at the end of conversations. Okay, then. Old fogey he was. I actually hang out at a coffee shop every afternoon these days. Paper Cup, by the airport. You could just meet me there. I'm generally there from 1 until 5, so just, you know, whenever works.
Cool. How about Thursday?
Sounds great. Larry resumed his business voice.
Thank you, Mackenzie. I look forward to it.
A loser who sits at home with her secrets. Mackenzie.
You can wear any of those, said Celeste, from the computer screen on Mackenzie's bed. They're the same. They're all black. Everything's black. This is the most ridiculous thing to stress over. They're not the same at all. This one's a V-neck. This one's short. Those are long. This one's got this lace piece here. Mackenzie pointed, her voice rising. This one has buttons.
You are the most extra, said Celeste.
At work, you're both in pirate costumes. He's going to see you in literally anything other than a pirate costume and go, oh, wow, she's not a pirate. And that's like so great.
He sees me at university all the time. He knows I'm not a pirate.
I think he knows you're not a pirate, Kenz. Just making a joke. Lighten up.
Mackenzie threw the one with buttons on the bed and covered her eyes.
I don't know how to date. Help me.
Kenz, you're going to be fine. Grant sounds amazing. And you see him like every day. This is the furthest thing from a blind date. It's not even a first date. You had that group date the other night.
Mackenzie sat on the floor, eye level with her laptop. It wasn't a group date. It was just a group.
Shut up. It was a group date. And it went well, you said. So I don't know why you're nervous. You're not wearing a parrot on your shoulder and you're not dressed like a pirate and you don't smell like Picaroon.
Except.
Celeste leaned into her laptop, her concerned face taking up the whole screen. What's wrong, Kenzie?
Mackenzie debated whether she should tell the truth or not. She picked the fresh nail polish off of her thumb.
I didn't actually go.
Didn't go where?
On the date, or the group date, or whatever it was. I stayed home.
Celeste sat so still that Mackenzie thought the FaceTime app was frozen. You lied about going on a date?
Yeah.
To me?
Yeah.
Mackenzie climbed onto the bed, and several black shirts fell to the floor at her feet. If Celeste only knew all the things Mackenzie had lied about.
Why?
Mackenzie fought the urge to shut the laptop.
Because I didn't want you to think I was a loser who sits at home by myself all the time.
Are you a loser who sits at home by yourself all the time?
Yeah.
Aw, Kenz.
Celeste never stayed mad. This was why their friendship was so easy. Neither of them ever stayed mad. It had probably been more of an inherent character trait for one of them, but like so many other traits and quirks and even physical mannerisms, they had spent so much time together growing up that it had rubbed off on the other.
Why? You were so excited to finally be out of your parents' house and away from that ridiculously oppressive curfew. You wanted to be free, remember? You wanted to actually leave your house after 7 p.m.? You wanted to go to movies, to parties, on dates?
I know. I did. And now that I'm actually here, I don't.
It actually sounds like you do, but you can't. Or won't, or something.
Celeste?
Mackenzie moved the computer over so she could lie down.
It's just this weird thing. It's like I've been living in a cage my whole life, but now the door is open and I can't go out there. It's scary.
But you're going tonight?
Mackenzie nodded.
Planning on it.
Also kind of planning on faking sick and canceling last minute.
Pick me up.
What?
Pick me up so I'm right in front of you. I want to talk straight to your face.
Mackenzie sat up obediently and held the laptop in front of her. Celeste's face was full screen again, her thick black eyebrows forming two straight, stern lines across her forehead.
You need to go tonight. You have to. If I were there, I'd promise to sneakily follow you in my car and watch over you, but I'm in Edmonton, which I realize now is an awful decision, and please forgive me. And you're just going to have to go on your own, and it will, I promise, feel so good to have done it, and I'll never forgive you if you don't.
You'll forgive me in like 2 seconds, Celeste.
Not this time. This time I will just stay mad until I die.
I miss you so much, Celeste.
Mackenzie put Celeste down so she could blow her nose.
So you're going?
I'm going to try to go.
Mackenzie picked up one of the black shirts.
Okay, so...
Is that your phone?
Huh?
I think I can hear your phone ringing.
Mackenzie dropped the shirt.
What if it's him? What if he's canceling?
Just answer it, Kenz.
Mackenzie sighed with relief when she saw her mother's number on the screen.
Hey, Mom.
Hi, baby. I just wanted to update you on the situation.
There's an update? Already?
The first time they'd gone through all this, They'd gotten used to going months without hearing anything, and the updates had always been fairly insignificant and meaningless. Until, of course, the final update, which had been about as insignificant and meaningless as an atomic bomb. She'd learned in that time that it did no good to feel joy about the investigation going well, or in this case, going at all, because that didn't mean it was going to end well. It did no good to feel despair about the investigation going poorly, either. Well, yes, actually. A fairly big one. Are you out in public? Is it loud where you are? Can you hear me? Mackenzie wanted to claw at her face. How, after all these years, were her parents still so bad at sharing news? Mom, yes, I can hear you. I'm home in my bedroom. I would tell you if I couldn't hear you. Just talk. Celeste burst into muffled laughter on the computer screen. She knew about Mackenzie's parents. Sorry. So, when they announced that they were reopening the case because they had received an anonymous tip, it apparently spooked someone into coming forward to confess that they had lied when they were questioned the first time. What? Mackenzie's heart beat louder than her mother's voice. She swallowed and wiped her forehead with the back of her hand. Her body registered agitation before she was even aware of the feeling. The pounding in her chest sounded like a word, a name. Jared, Jared, Jared. She moved out of Celeste's line of sight. Who was it? She knew she should ask. Was it considered lying to ask questions you already knew the answers to? Jared Hall. Do you remember him? Tanya's friend? When they questioned him the first time, he said he was home watching TV that night, and his parents backed him up. Now he's saying he was with them. Mackenzie breathed in deeply, trying to sound surprised. At least surprise and guilt didn't sound much different. Jared? Yeah, I think I remember him. She tried to say it quietly. Celeste knew that she'd kept her relationship with Jared a secret from her parents, but it still felt weird lying in front of someone who knew you were lying. Why did he lie the first time? Mackenzie's mother sighed heavily. He was covering for his parents. They supplied the alcohol for a small party that happened that night just outside of town. And he's saying that's the last place he saw. Her voice slid up an octave. To think he and his family were more afraid of the repercussions for hosting that party than they were for our daughter's safety? To think that they, that all of those kids who were there were more afraid of getting in trouble for underage drinking than... She composed herself. Everyone just thought, you know, it's a small town where nothing bad has ever happened. They ran away, they'll turn up. And then by the time anyone realized what a big deal it was, they felt they couldn't take it back. They'd already lied to the police. To think of the guilt they've probably been living with for all these years. And rightfully so. Mackenzie couldn't listen to this anymore. Will they be in trouble? Jared and his family? I'm guessing they will. Her mother's voice was hard and angry, more of a wish than a guess. So they know what happened? Have they said anything yet other than... Jared has given a statement. The police are looking into things, said her mother. This was the first time anyone had uttered these words since that night. Until that point, it had always been, no one seems to know anything, or if anyone knows something, they're not saying. That second one had always killed Mackenzie, because she knew of a few people who knew something they weren't saying. She was one of them. First date. Mackenzie. The doorbell rang, and Mackenzie realized she'd never heard it before, because the only people who ever came to see her were Maud and Suna, and they were already in the house. How long had she lived here now? How long had she been going to this university, mingling with other students and working with people at Picaroon? Was it pathetic that this was the first time she'd heard the doorbell? If she had to hazard a guess, yeah, pretty pathetic. She took a breath, locked the door behind her, and marched up the stairs. When she opened the front door, the sight of Grant caught her off guard, even though she'd been expecting him. He looked out of place on her porch. It was weird, in a good way, that he'd come to her house just to see her. Any other time they'd been together, they'd had reasons to be in the same room that had nothing to do with each other. Now he was on her porch purely because it was her porch. It felt like such an immature thing to be processing it all so consciously. But Mackenzie had only ever dated Jared, and that had been a big secret. And she had never felt quite certain that she was the reason he was with her. "Hey," said Grant, "this house is really cool. It's got character." "Yeah, doesn't it?" said Mackenzie, so glad he hadn't opened by telling her she looked nice or giving her flowers. Jared had done those things because they were easy, generic things to do.
"It looks like it's haunted," said Grant.
Mackenzie smiled in spite of the chill that shot up her back.
"Why do you say that?"
"It's just got that, like, old-school ghost house thing."
"Well," said Mackenzie, "you'll be happy to know that it is haunted. There was a suicide in the attic or something?"
Grant looked like he wasn't sure if Mackenzie was joking or not, but he also looked like he didn't mind one way or the other.
"Whoa," he said. "Freaky."
"You have no idea," Mackenzie said sincerely.
"Shall we?"
"Definitely." She stepped onto the porch and locked the front door behind her just as nonchalantly as if she did this every night. As though this was not, in fact, the first time she'd ever gone out on a real date. She felt like she was doing something brave and extreme and extraordinary. But she didn't want Grant to know she felt like that, so she smiled at him and asked, "Where do you want to go?" He looked like he wasn't completely sure of what he was about to suggest, but was also very excited about it.
"So there's this thing at RPL they do sometimes, where they play old kids' movies? Beethoven, Air Bud, Big Green, stuff like that?"
He drew in a breath and squinted at her, like he was about to jam a nail into his own foot.
"With the sound off? And they have a local improv team come in and do funny voiceovers? It's awesome. I don't know if it's technically first date material, but..."
"That sounds amazing," she said. "And I don't think there are rules about first date material anymore. Are we going to drive?"
"Can, if you don't like walking. Or we can walk if you don't like driving. Or we can do whichever one you hate less. Or whichever one you like more. Either way's good."
He was talking faster than usual.
"Are you nervous, Grant?"
"Yeah." That made Mackenzie feel a bit better.
"Don't be. It's just me. Let's walk then, if there's time."
"Yeah, the RPL isn't far from here.
If we were going to drive, I was going to say we could stop for ice cream first at dessert, but this way we'll make it just in time. We can go for ice cream after. Show's at 7:30.
Mackenzie felt short of breath. "Either way's good. Walk or drive, whatever. This way or that way." She was walking off into the evening with a guy she barely knew. They had very loose plans, nothing in writing. No work schedule for police to consult later. No eyewitness accounts from other employees that she had or hadn't shown up. No, she was supposed to be at Picaroon at 8, so she would have left the house at 7:45. No, she left work early because she wasn't feeling well. And here's a detailed description of the suspicious-looking man who followed her to her car. She could vanish without a trace or a clue. And for some reason, the thought of that didn't scare her for her own sake. It scared her for the people she might leave behind.
"Either way's good," she said. Should I just...
He looked at her with concern, and she thought she probably looked like she was about to pass out.
"Grant, I feel like I'm going to be sick."
And she ran to the side of the porch and puked over the railing onto the lawn below, hating the sound she made and the way she convulsed as she emptied out. When she was finished, she stood and wiped her mouth.
"I think I need to go back to bed," she said hoarsely,
without turning to look at him.
"I'm so sorry, Grant. You should leave so you don't catch this."
Death kits in Manila. Suna. "Did you know that you can buy death kits in Manila?" asked Maud. Suna was confused. Death kits? What time was it?
Why was Maud here in her bedroom? It was dark. So dark, in fact, that Suna couldn't even see Maud's outline. She was just a voice that came out of nowhere. A disembodied sound. Words that didn't make sense. Maud, she said. What are you doing in my bedroom? What time is it? What are you talking? Death kits, said Maud. Her voice was wandering around. In the Philippines. Suna, I'm trying to find your light switch and... Oh. The overhead light came on, and Suna screeched, pulling the covers over her face. Suna, just close your eyes for a moment and let them adjust. I'm going to trip over something and break my hip if I keep wandering around your place in the dark. Suna lowered her sheets, squinting against the light. So your solution is to turn the light on instead of to stop wandering around my place in the dark? Suna, I need to borrow your Google.
You need to borrow my what? My Google?
Like you mean you want to borrow my phone? Is there a Google on your phone?
Well, yeah.
Then yes, as soon as possible. Do you keep it in your bedroom?
Suna was too tired to be angry.
What time is it? 1 o'clock. I'm sorry, but this couldn't wait, and I figured you'd be up. This is about the time you usually go prowling around other people's apartments, isn't it?
I'm sleeping, Maud. Get out.
Are you listening to me? Death kits.
Are you listening to me? I'm sleeping.
Maud sat down on Suna's bed. Remember when you told Mackenzie that I owed her because I was spying on her, and that gave her free rein to break into my apartment?
Suna tried to emulate a blank look.
She told me you said that to her. Frankly, I really don't see how this is any different. You owe me because you broke into my apartment. That's much worse than using the microfiche at the library. One is illegal, and one...
Suna was fully awake now, and furious. And yet, she couldn't argue with this logic. She waved her hand in front of her face like Maud was a gnat.
Fine, fine, Maud, fine. My phone is on the nightstand. It's unlocked. Unlocked? What does that mean?
It means I don't have a passcode on it.
What's a passcode? Like a combination lock?
Maud looked confounded.
Yeah. Why would you put a combination lock on your phone? So that if someone else is in an emergency situation and they need to call for help, they can't?
Yep, said Suna, turning over and burying her face in her pillow. Maud picked up the phone and stared at it.
How does it work? She asked. She squinted at the black screen. Can you get Google on it?
Suna grabbed the phone out of Maud's hands.
Okay, Maud, here I am. I'm awake. How about you tell me why you want to Google death kits, and then if you have a good enough reason, I'll do it for you. Death kits, said Maud, not death kids.
Suna probably looked like she was going to kill Maud because Maud began nodding.
Okay, so I was at the library and I was talking to a young man there about Mackenzie.
Really, Maud? She asked you not to look into it at all, and now you're talking to strangers about it?
He asked.
Oh, really? He asked. A stranger walked up to you in a library and said, Oh, excuse me, do you know anything about this cold case from 6 years ago?
No. He saw me looking at the microfiche.
Suna cocked her head to the side. Maud, I thought you got everything you needed off the microfiche.
Mackenzie told me that if I thought she was Kate, then I hadn't seen everything, or I was missing information. She told me quite emphatically that she was not Kate. And you know what? I believed her, because she looked so arrogant. I could tell that I was wrong. It was like she was challenging me.
Maud looked around Suna's bedroom, her eyes lingering judgmentally on anything that looked out of place.
I took that as permission.
You would. Maud? Is there a chance that all this snooping is just you trying to distract yourself from the Richard thing?
Maud went off into a coughing fit and flapped her hands at Suna.
When she'd recovered, she cleared her throat a few times and cast a disdainful glance at the other woman.
The Richard thing? You mean our meeting next Thursday? Why would I try to distract myself from that? I feel great about it.
You feel great about it?
Yes. I look forward to getting to the bottom of it. I like to get to the bottom of things, which is why I want to get to the bottom of this.
Suna shrugged.
Okay. So, You saw the picture in that Cake Blade magazine. The girl in that picture had the same tattoo as Mackenzie and the same face as Mackenzie and the same hair as Mackenzie, so I thought it was Mackenzie. Rookie mistake. They're twins. They have matching tattoos and faces and hair. Of course they do. It's obvious, and I don't know why it didn't cross my mind sooner. People probably get sister tattoos all the time. And why would she change her last name but not her first? Marriage. The magazine articles are recent, so Kate Weiss, nay Simons, is very much alive. But according to the newspaper, like I said before, is still technically missing. Why? She went missing but is somehow still publishing music articles? Interesting. And Tanya's dead, right? According to those old newspaper articles. But we also have this mysterious third person, Mackenzie Simons, who isn't mentioned anywhere but has the same face as Kate and presumably Tanya. And here's something, Suna. I asked the librarian if she had any way to find a list of people who had graduated from the high school in Mackenzie's hometown, and she got right on her Google for me and searched. She told me small-town newspapers often have a picture of that year's graduating class with a little write-up and a list of graduates. And she couldn't find one single Mackenzie Simons in the last 10 years in any of the newspaper archives. Not one. Anyway, I was trying to find what I'd missed, and this young man asked me to show him how to use the microfiche machine. He saw what I was looking up and said it looked interesting, and of course it was interesting, so I explained the whole thing to him, about how there were these twins, and one is dead and one is still missing, but I've sort of located the missing one and somehow also got an extra one living in my basement. It's like a riddle. And I told him how I thought Mackenzie was Kate, but that I'd been wrong, so I was coming back to see what I could possibly have gotten wrong, and he says to me, "Are you sure she's not Tanya?" And I said that no, of course she's not Tanya because Tanya is dead and they have the body and they had a funeral and all that. And he says, "Google death kits." Then I asked him what in the world he was talking about. And he was telling me about how you can buy a body and a death certificate and even eyewitnesses to say they saw you die. And he said something about how maybe Tanya, Mackenzie, purchased a death kit and faked her own death. And then he looked at the clock on the wall by the door and said he had to go and thanked me for the microfiche lesson. Isn't it all so bizarre? And now you see why I need your Google. I don't feel like I should ask a librarian to search for death kits on hers. Suna glared at Maud. Maud, if you don't get out of my room right now, I am going to buy you a death kit. Suna couldn't fall back asleep after Maud left. She grabbed the phone off the nightstand, pulled up Facebook, and typed in Mackenzie Simons. She clicked through several profiles belonging to women with that name, but found no one who looked like the girl living in the basement suite. She tried Mackenzie Weiss, then Kate Weiss. No luck. She tried the same combinations on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat. Nothing, nothing, nothing. But Mackenzie was 19. She was probably on some other social media network Suna had never heard of. One last-ditch effort. She Googled her. Again, nothing under Mackenzie's name. Kate Weiss had a very nice portfolio of music essays and reviews, but no social media accounts. Nothing personal. What 19-year-old didn't have a digital footprint? Suna glanced at the door. She was sandwiched between some seriously troubling people right now. One of them, a suspect in a police investigation, and one who seemed like maybe she didn't exist. She pulled up Facebook again and typed another name, Tanya Simons. This search rewarded her with one account belonging to someone in Saskatchewan, but this page was different from a regular Facebook account. Suna had never seen a memorialized account before. The profile picture was a tiny, faraway shot of a group of teenagers, one of whom was presumably Tanya Simons. The friends list was still there, and some basic profile information, but the page was largely a place where loved ones left messages, as though the girl had a laptop and reliable Wi-Fi with her in her grave. One read, "Tanya, my baby girl was born today, right on her due date.
I named her after you, so part of you will be with me every day. It might be my imagination, but I feel like she has your eyes. Miss you so much, Angel. Depressing.
Suna clicked on the profile picture. Wanting to see a clearer picture than the grainy one printed over and over in the newspaper articles. She didn't see a Mackenzie lookalike in the group shot, so she looked at the next one. Something was off, if this was indeed Tanya Simons. She looked nothing at all like Mackenzie. Not in a twin way or even a sister way. Where Mackenzie was tall and tan and dark-eyed, this girl was tiny and pale, with frizzy red curls and freckles all over her face and shoulders. She typed, Kate Simons, ignoring her shame as she pictured herself reprimanding Maud for doing this very thing. Can't help it, I'm just like my dad. This account, too, was memorialized. The notes were similar to the ones on Tanya's account, only they had the occasional note of hope. I still believe you're out there somewhere, Kate. Come home to us. The only picture of Kate Simons confused Suna even more. She looked exactly like Tanya. Maud was right, hard as it was to admit. Mackenzie was lying to them. But Maud was wrong about a lot of things. This was also blatantly obvious. Kate and Tanya were identical twin sisters, and they were both gone. One dead, one missing. So who was Mackenzie? And why would she pretend to be the dead twin sister of someone who had gone missing? And who was Kate Weiss? Suna was tired of wondering why someone had done something or what they were thinking. It was exhausting. Mackenzie's actions were strange. But Suna wasn't going to run all over the city visiting libraries and talking to strangers about death kits to get her answers. She would just ask Mackenzie. Do ghosts have feet? Mackenzie. Mackenzie vaguely registered the sound of knocking, but it spliced itself into the dream she was having so neatly that, for a few moments, she thought she was being steadily, painlessly beat over the head with a 2x4. Her heart quickened as she realized the sound was coming from her door. She tried to push the thought of ghosts away. She tiptoed to the door, moved the chair, jogged silently up the stairs to the next door, and tried to see through the crack underneath. Were there human feet there, or horrors? Nothing. Feet. Did ghosts have feet? These feet were bare, which meant, barring the supernatural, that it was most likely either Maud or Suna. Or a barefoot Grant, come back for a second helping of abject humiliation for everybody? Yes, she whispered cautiously. Mac, it's Suna. Mackenzie breathed a sigh of relief and opened the door. Hey, what time is it? Huh. Suna popped her hip out and clucked her tongue. I am so sorry. I just got mad at Maud for coming to my place in the middle of the night, and then I did the same to you. Although, Mac, I woke up to her in my bedroom, sitting on my bed. But what time is it? Mackenzie heard her voice crack and self-consciously pulled on the bottom of her oversized sleeping shirt. Right, sorry, I actually don't know, like two-ish. Wait, she was on your bed? Well, not at first, but yeah. I woke up to her in my bedroom. Honestly, Mac, I almost wished it was a ghost. And what are you doing here? Now?
Can I come in?
Sure. Mackenzie led the way to the table and slumped into one of the chairs, rubbing the sleep out of her eyes. What's up?
Oh, man. Where do I even start?
Suna sat, too. She looked awkward and apologetic. I don't know, said Mackenzie. Feeling uneasy. This would have to do with Kate and Tanya, for sure. Suna was acting too weird for it to be anything else.
So,
Suna searched Mackenzie's kitchen, moving her eyes along the countertops and the tops of the cupboards.
I snooped. Like Maud. I'm sorry. I couldn't help myself. I was on Facebook. You know how easy it is to snoop around when you're on social media. It's too easy, you know? You almost can't blame people.
Mackenzie sat across from Suna, holding as still as she could. She did know. It was easy. But that didn't mean you had to. It wasn't impossible not to snoop if you exercised some self-control. These nosy women, why wouldn't they leave it all alone?
I shouldn't have, but I searched for them on Facebook, Suna continued. I saw a picture, like a clearer one than in the papers. And Maud's completely wrong. Neither of them are you.
True, said Mackenzie. I never said either of them were.
You said your twin sister went missing, and Kate and Tanya Simons are the names of the twins who went missing on their birthday. But I saw their pictures, and you look nothing like them. At all. Not in a blown-out newspaper article or a clear Facebook profile picture.
I never said my twin sister went missing. What are you talking about? Suna looked lost. She lowered her head onto the table.
I don't know, Mac, she said, her voice muffled. I think I'm getting the things you said confused with the things Maud said. She found these articles about Kate and Tanya Simons, these missing twins. I think she filled in some blanks.
Maud? Fill in blanks? That's ridiculous, Suna. Suna lifted her head to see if Mackenzie was kidding. Maybe also to see if Mackenzie making jokes equaled Mackenzie not being angry. She was, but it didn't. Anyway, yes, Kate and Tanya are my sisters. They're twins, and I'm the perpetual third wheel.
Suna sat up. Okay. And who's the one you think wrote the letter? Tanya?
Mackenzie felt a laugh climb her throat. But it was the kind that comes when your body knows there are too many emotions inside and it needs to get rid of some very quickly. No. Tanya didn't write the letter because Tanya's dead. We have her body. It's in a box in a hole, covered with dirt. Tanya's not writing letters or asking to meet up with me in a coffee shop because she's super, super dead. I do have maybe a fraction of a dream that the writer of that letter is Kate. But I'm pretty sure she's, you know, not writing letters anymore either. Suna waited a respectful amount of time to speak again. An unspoken moment of silence for each of the dead girls.
Who's Kate Weiss?
She said finally. Me. It's my pen name. Kate, because obviously. And Weiss, the last name of the lead singer of one of my favorite bands. I like to write, but I started pretty young and my parents wouldn't let me, so I picked a pen name and did it anyway.
Okay. But then who are you?
What do you mean, who am I? I'm Mackenzie Simons, the accused.
I looked you up. On social media, I couldn't find you anywhere.
Welcome to the world of a kid whose older sisters disappeared into thin air. You think my parents were going to let me have social media accounts? You think my parents were going to let me finish high school in peace? They pulled me that week. Bam. Homeschooled. Good thing I had Celeste or I would have died. It was the worst. That's why they don't even mention me in the newspaper articles. My parents didn't know if the kidnapper, or whoever, was going to come back for me, so they asked for a publication ban on me. It was like they thought if no one knew I existed, I'd be safe. Real great way to grow up. You have no idea what a huge deal it is that I'm even living here in a house in a city this far from home. I fought for it. I fought for it so hard. And now that I'm here, I just think about going home every single day. I'm petrified 24/7 because I'm pretty sure fear is just imprinted into my DNA at this point. But I'm here. Do you want to know something else? I've never even gone out on a real date. Or to a movie. Or anything. I have not, since that night my sisters went missing, left the house after supper, besides to work. Because I just have it in my head that if I go out at night and I disappear, they won't have enough clues to be able to find me. Or there'll be like one person who saw me last and the entire investigation will hinge on that one person's testimony. Which, can you imagine the toll that would take on a person? Mackenzie was talking too fast. She took a breath. Any other questions? Do you want to know why I don't look anything like them? Suna looked like she was deciding whether Mackenzie was actually giving her permission. If she'd looked uncomfortable before, now she looked like she was scoping the apartment for places to hide, like she might actually attempt to climb into Mackenzie's fridge. Mackenzie felt okay about letting Suna marinate in her embarrassment. Maybe it would teach her a lesson. But curiosity won.
Do you guys have different dads or moms or...
Mackenzie sat back in her chair, disappointed in Suna.
Yeah.
Different dads?
Different dads and moms.
So, then you're not even sisters?
No, we are sisters. We just have different parents. Different biological parents.
Oh, adopted.
Mackenzie nodded.
They are.
Okay, said Suna. Why didn't you just say that in the beginning?
I didn't see why I needed to.
Mackenzie was just beginning to fully appreciate how odd this trio was. Suna, Maud, herself. They were the kind of close where they demanded extremely personal information from each other, though they had just met and didn't even know the basics about one another yet.
I'm really, really sorry, Mac. I shouldn't have snooped. I shouldn't have asked so many questions. It's none of my business. The frustrating thing is that I've been giving Maud this exact lecture over and over, thinking I was so much better than her, and then I did the exact same thing.
No, I get it. I catch myself thinking like that a lot, too. That I'm better than Maud.
Mackenzie hadn't realized she felt like that until she said it out loud, and then she wished she hadn't admitted it.
We should be nicer to her, she mumbled.
By we, you mean me?
No, I mean we. We've been alive about a third of the time she has, and we treat her like she's two. That's not fair. She's not dumb. She's just fed up with everything. And I bet it didn't help, getting stood up for her own wedding.
Poor Maud. Maybe having something like that happen to you made it so you stopped seeing anything good in yourself. Maybe Maud just hated having to exist in front of other people, and that was what made her mean.
I bet all this investigative stuff is just her trying to distract herself from the Richard thing,
Mackenzie said, feeling worse by the second. Suna slammed the table like Maud always did.
That's exactly what I said.
Maud says no, though. She says she's excited about the meeting with him.
Excited?
Suna shrugged. That's what she said.
Mackenzie's phone buzzed on the counter and she sighed.
This is going to be something,
she mumbled, leaving the phone right where it was.
What do you mean?
I mean that I'm going to answer this phone call and it's going to be something. I'm, what did Maud say? One of those people.
She grabbed the phone and hit the green circle without checking to see whose name was on the screen.
Mackenzie?
It was her father. His voice was cautious and creaky.
We've heard from the police.
There was a whooshing sound, like a washing machine, and she observed with some interest, but no alarm or sense of personal involvement, that it was the sound of blood rushing around in her head, as though her heart were in her ears. And suddenly, she was thinking about the summer she turned 9. She'd gone to a baseball tournament in a neighboring town. Her team had just played their first game, and she, along with a small group of teammates, was headed to the snack bar to buy a hot dog. They'd been walking past a game in progress, and someone had yelled, "Heads!" Mackenzie had known this meant she should look up and around, that she should put her hands up to cover her face. But as she glanced up, something in the sky caught her attention, and time slowed as she wondered what the thing was. She stared straight at it. Right as she realized what the small white thing was, it knocked her out. But there had been a fraction of a second in which she understood everything with horrible clarity, in which she knew that it was a baseball, that it was going to hit her in the face, and that it was going to hurt. A moment between comprehension and pain. Why were they having this conversation here in this haunted house with all the ghosts? She wanted to be in her living room, sitting on the couch between her parents. She wanted to have her head on her dad's chest when he told her this news. She knew what it was. She just wasn't ready for it to land yet.
I'm on my way home, Dad, she blurted before he could say anything more.
Now? He sounded relieved.
Yeah, right now. I'll be there in an hour and a half.
Okay, he said.
Love you, Mac.
Love you, Dad. Suna, who was sitting close enough to hear the whole thing,
seemed to magically understand what neither Mackenzie nor her dad had said out loud.
"Want some company?"
she asked. Mackenzie couldn't speak, but she nodded gratefully.
Suna's First Night Sky. Suna.
Suna stared out the window as they passed the town where Mackenzie grew up. The houses were old, the lawns overgrown, the grain elevator standing guard at the entrance like an old man who was tired of his job. Mackenzie seemed not to notice how dilapidated it all was. She pointed out the tiny school building, the church, the bank, the post office, the gas station, and the bar, all visible from the highway, lined up like a ghost town on a TV set.
"That's basically it," Mackenzie said.
The town disappeared in the rearview mirror as quickly as it had appeared in front of them.
"There's a hall and a senior citizens center, too, and a big hole where there used to be a swimming pool, before I was born. Kids used to climb into it and do drugs."
The sparse streetlights were the last of the town to vanish, and they were back in the country again, beneath the enormous black sky. Suna was mesmerized by it. An incredible thing, an almost unbelievable thing, was that this was her first time seeing an unobstructed night sky. She'd grown up in Toronto. Her family, when they still called themselves a family anyway, didn't camp. They vacationed in other cities. Montreal, Vancouver, New York, Seattle, Boston. Wherever her dad's work took him, Suna and her mother followed along and called it family vacation, though they never saw him. If she had ever been out from under the canopy of city lights at night, she couldn't recall it. And she would recall something like this. Endless night, filled with stars. Speckled, like someone had flicked a paintbrush at a large dark canvas.
"I've never seen anything like this before," she said.
Mackenzie looked shocked, as though she'd forgotten Suna was in the car with her. But then Suna realized it wasn't that she'd spoken, it was what she'd said that had surprised Mackenzie.
"Huh? Seen anything like what?"
"The sky," said Suna. "I've never seen anything like it before."
You've never seen the sky?"
Suna laughed. "No. Grew up in the city, stayed in the city. And Regina's small, but, I mean, it's still got streetlights. When I first got here, I remember getting up at 5 a.m. for a class. And it was late summer still, so it wasn't pitch black like this. But I still remember thinking, whoa, the sky is so big out here. But this..."
Mackenzie slammed on the brakes and swerved into an empty approach that seemed invisible from the road. She threw the car into park and got out.
Suna followed, confused.
"What are you doing, Mac?"
Mackenzie climbed up onto the car's hood. The night was dark enough that you could see every star, but the stars were bright enough that the women could see each other, as though they were in town under the glow of streetlights.
"I just need a minute," she said, "to rest my eyes and..."
Suna waited for her to finish the sentence, then realized she wasn't going to.
Suna climbed onto the hood of the car, too, pulling her jacket across her chest.
"I can't believe you've never seen this. It's amazing, hey?"
Mackenzie tipped her head back and stared straight up.
"When I first got my license, I used to do this all the time on my way home from town, especially if I was upset. I'd pull off the road and lie on my car and just look up. It's so big. It's familiar to me, but it's one of those familiar things that stays amazing." "Really, how many familiar things stay amazing?"
Suna thought about it. She didn't feel amazed by much lately. Was that just part of getting older? Or was it more like a muscle that atrophied if you didn't move it for a long time? She tried to pick a square section of the sky and count just the stars inside of it, but couldn't. It was amazing. She heard a sniffle from beside her and tried not to turn her head, to let Mackenzie have some semblance of privacy.
"Are you nervous?"
"About what?"
"About finding out what happened."
"No."
Mackenzie sniffled again.
"Oh."
Suna didn't know what to say to that. Mackenzie was quiet for a long time.
"I'm not nervous to find out what happened because I already know what happened."
Mackenzie looked sideways at Suna, then quickly away.
"You mean, like, you can guess?"
"No. I mean, I know what happened. And yeah, if you're wondering, that does mean I lied to the police and to my parents and to everyone.
She had her head tipped back now, like she was confessing her sins to God, and it seemed probable out here that he was very close, listening. Suna felt like if she jumped high enough, she could brush her fingers against the sky and some of the stars would rub off like glitter. It had moved closer to them while they sat there, she thought. Like Ma did when she was talking to you, drifting closer and closer without you noticing.
My parents don't know. That I know, I mean. I caught Cade and Tanya sneaking out the window that night, and Tanya made me promise not to tell on them. I read their email all the time back then. They never signed out of their accounts, just left them open on their laptops in their bedroom. That's how I found out they were looking for their biological family. They'd go on these forums where adoptees entered personal information like what hospital they were born in, birth dates, anything they knew about their birth parents, whatever.
You didn't like that they were on those forums?
Suna could tell. I didn't. I hated that they wanted other family. They came to my parents as babies, so they were already there when I came along. And I felt like if they were enough for me, I should be enough for them. I didn't understand that they weren't looking for extra people. Do you know what I mean? I didn't get it. And I didn't try to get it. Which was really unfair.
She was talking upward again, confessing.
I didn't know what it was like to not know where someone is. Someone who's intrinsically a part of you. I didn't know how much a person would want to know where that person was and why they weren't with you. I didn't get that you could love the people you were with while still agonizing over the unanswered questions about the ones you weren't with. And the worst part of all this is that now I get it. And now I would be so sympathetic to them. And I would help them find their bio family because I get it. But I only get it because they're not here.
Mackenzie drew in a long, shaky breath.
They found this guy named Owen on one of the forums. He convinced them that he was their older brother, and after a few months of emailing back and forth with them, he had this story about his house burning to the ground and needing money for a plane ticket to California. He said he had a hunch that's where their birth mother was. He asked for money and promised to repay them as soon as he could, and he said that if he found their mother, he'd try to convince her to come back with him and meet them. That's where they went that night, to meet Owen and give him all their money.
And your mom's wedding rings. Mackenzie seemed not to hear this, and Suna was glad. She'd never had someone confess something so huge to her before, and it was hard to hear it without trying to reply to it.
So it was me. Mackenzie's voice rose, like she'd only just realized no one would overhear her. It must have felt good, not only to unburden herself, but also to do it so loudly. The anonymous tip that made them reopen the case. I called it in on a payphone. I gave them the forum and their username and password. Something I should have done a long time ago.
Suna was speechless. Which was probably good, because she knew if she were to speak, she'd say the wrong thing. There were no right things to say about something like that.
I know you're probably judging me so hard right now, said Mackenzie,
and Suna cringed. She was. She couldn't help it. She didn't want to be.
I was 13. I was so mad at them for leaving me behind on our birthday, but I also didn't want them to hate me for ratting them out. I didn't know.
Mackenzie's voice rose and wavered.
That not ratting them out would mean I'd never see them again. I was pretty sheltered, and it honestly didn't cross my mind that this was what was going to happen. I honestly thought this, Suna, that what had happened to them happened before they met up with Owen, that me giving that information to the police didn't matter because it was unrelated. Isn't that so stupid?
Then Mackenzie had to stop talking for a few minutes, and Suna kept quiet too. Mackenzie was quiet for so long that it startled Suna when she spoke again. She'd gone her whole life without absolute silence, and then gotten used to it in 10 minutes.
This is part of it too, said Mackenzie slowly. Jared also knew. He was the one who drove them there. He was Tanya's friend then, not mine. I always thought that they were dating when she disappeared, but he was never straight with me about it. How did you know he knew? He came by the next day. My parents were driving all over the place looking for my sisters, and I was supposed to stay home and answer the phone in case they called. My mom had gone by his house to see if my sisters were there, or Tanya at least, and he told her he'd been home the previous evening and hadn't seen them. But I'd seen them all leave that night, and I'd thrown this big fit about being left behind. He knew I knew. He was really jumpy and agitated. He said Kate and Tanya left the party early. He didn't know when or with who, just that at one point he looked around and they were both gone. He said he never saw the guy they were supposed to meet. But he wasn't worried about them. They'd probably just gone to someone's house and slept over. He was annoyed that my parents were worried and was acting like it was this huge inconvenience that he had to come over to my place. But he told me, Mackenzie paused and shifted in the darkness, that I couldn't tell anyone about it. Turns out he was covering for his parents, who hosted the party. Can you believe that? That parents would ask their kid to lie for them? And then ask me to lie for them too? And here's the biggest, stupidest part. I had a crush on him. So I promised I wouldn't say anything. A crush, Suna. Mackenzie studied the big black cavern above them. I didn't tell anyone what I knew. I think I even believed him at first that it was no big deal, that my sisters were probably at another friend's place. And then by the time the police started asking questions, I'd already lied to my parents, told them I'd gone to sleep right after the party and didn't hear them leave. I was so naive. It all felt irreversible and scary. I was scared of them thinking I was guilty of something horrible because I'd lied. I was scared of my parents thinking my sisters could have been saved if I hadn't lied. And I was really, really scared that was true. Still am, honestly. She laughed weakly. I was, I realize now, even scared of Jared, which got even more complicated when he and I started dating. Secretly dating because my parents... Suna, it was all just... No, I get it. You don't have to make excuses. I kept being scared. And now it's just, you know, I can't ever tell them. Mac, they'd understand. You were 13. People make terrible decisions when they're 13. You'd feel better? No. You should have heard my mom on the phone the other day, talking about those people who cared more about not getting into trouble than about her daughters. And I'm one of those people. They'd never forgive me. And they can't afford that. They've already lost two daughters, you know? So, today I'll go home, and my parents will tell us what they found out about Owen, and that the police caught him, and it'll all just go away. Apparently Jared told his side of the story too, so good. That's it. It's over. Suna shook her head. She knew what happened to relationships if you ignored things instead of working through them. She'd seen what happened between her parents. What had happened with her and her mother, her and her father, her and Brett. What had happened to the sidewalk in front of their house where the tree roots began to grow through it. Stuff like that doesn't just go away, Mac. Mackenzie frowned, but she didn't say anything more. A spectral howling sound filled the air, and Suna grabbed Mackenzie's arm. It's just coyotes, said Mackenzie calmly. But then she laughed. They sound like ghosts, don't they? Larry goes to a show. Larry was dressed in his favorite outfit, sourced from a thrift store in 1990. Gray double XL pinstriped dress pants his sister Glenda had altered in her 10th grade home economics class to fit him. Old black and white chucks with holes in both heels. A teeny tiny, impossibly tight black t-shirt. Had he gotten it in the kids section? With a giant smiley face. A small rip by the right armpit was held together with safety pins. He'd been caught in a tough place in his teens. He loved punk fashion. The colorful hair, the plaid, the big boots and patches and dog collars and leather jackets. But then there was the whole anti-fashion punk movement, and he wanted to be part of that, too, because it sounded right. The music, it was only ever about the music. But also, he lived in Regina, Saskatchewan, where a lot of politics and statements that drove punk in other regions were often ignored. So in the end, he found himself somewhere in the middle. A toned-down version of the English punks, an amped-up version of the anti-fashion crowd. And tonight, he was back. He felt young again. His clothes still fit. He was going to a punk show. He put a notepad in his pocket. He was going to write a review of the show and send it to a few local publications. It was time. It would be dark in the venue. He'd blend right in with the kids. He'd stand in the back and feel the bass vibrating up his spine. He could reclaim that feeling. Maybe he'd get something pierced. Maybe he'd see a girl across the room and she'd walk over. They wouldn't be able to talk during the show. It would be way too loud. But afterward, he'd say, "Hey, I don't feel like going home yet. Do you want to go to Smitty's with me?" Did people still do that? He chided himself. Didn't matter what kids did now. She would be older, like him. She would remember the scene the way he did. The kids would see them standing in the back and feel impressed. Respectful. Awed, even. He locked the apartment door, watched his legs walk down the stairs, satisfied with his pinstriped pants. He caught his reflection in the car window as he leaned down to unlock the door. He looked a little like Guy Picciotto. He felt like Guy Picciotto. In less than 15 minutes, he went from Guy Picciotto to Mr. Rogers. He was, for one thing, the first to arrive. The website said the band would start at 7, so he was there at 1:45. This part of things, to be fair, was foreign to him.